What's up, Brennan? How you doing?
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
I'm pretty good. It's a windy day here off the coast of Maine. We are back in the studio after 2 weeks. What you got? What you got for me?
it has been a relatively busy couple of weeks. There's been a lot of articles and stuff that I've seen come out that I think are kind of interesting in terms of relevancy with what we talk about. People saying that, you know, film might die away because commercial labs are going away. I think that's kind of a relevant topic for you.
It is, you know, and we can certainly get into it, but I thought we'd do some house cleaning. So first I'll just say that Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark Room is the photography podcast that has Animal IAF. Welcome back, everyone. I will not be talking about new camera announcements this week. I find them ridiculously boring. Although I will say that, like, there's one guy who I will not name. Every time someone makes Sony makes an announcement, like, of a new camera, like for this week, they announced, I don't know, the A30, whatever, who cares? It's an APS-C consumer camera. And,
it's the A6400, Mark.
Yeah. Great. It's great. the only takeaway I had from it was Animal IAF, which I, you know, to be honest with you, like, as a person that takes a lot of pictures of dogs, my dogs, that sounds like a great feature, but it's just the name. It just sounds like something that, like a cologne that you would wear in Anchorman.
Animal IAF?
Yeah. Anyway, this guy, every time like Sony makes an announcement, this guy makes these, like cryptic posts on Facebook where he's just like, "Bravo, Sony, you've done it again." But then he doesn't link back to like whatever they've done. So if that happens, I'm like,
well, of course not. Yeah, what he means is they brought up a new camera that replaces like another camera that they did 6 months ago.
Yeah. And, I guess it's got some kind of feature that he finds charming.
probably Animal IAF.
You know what? The day that Nikon announces the F7 is the day that I'll get on Facebook and say, "Bravo, Nikon," and do like the clapping gif from Orson Welles or something like that.
It would be really exciting. It would be very unexpected.
Generally, I'm not a fan of cheering on like the announcements of new brands. I mean, if Rolleiflex came back from the dead and we're like, we're making TLRs, that would be another one. I guess like I'm film biased here. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I guess I would do it for Kodak too. So basically what I'm getting at is that I'm completely full of shit in making fun of this guy, because I would do the same things if it was companies that I cared about.
Yes. It's okay though, because it seems like, you know, most new digital cameras come out are slight improvements on what they were before. So it's not really anything that exciting. But, you know, when, you know, if Nikon released an F7, for example, would be really exciting. That'd be pretty awesome.
That'd be great.
And very unexpected and very cool, because it's like, hopefully would be leaps and bounds better than the F6.
It would take me 10 years to be able to afford one, which I think is the case with the F6. But I'd be happy that it existed. It's just one of those things that you just want to see out there in the world.
Yes, definitely. I agree 100%.
Anyway, let's get into it. So this is the first podcast after the week of announcements that I made. I was even going to do an additional announcement that had to do with the printer that I got, but I kind of decided to wait on it because I have the printer and you've made fun of me for this. I still have not turned it on.
That's what a shame.
It's like, I haven't plugged it in. My friend came and we took the crate apart, 'cause it comes in a crate. It's like the size of a Volkswagen Bug. And we like took it that apart and we put it on its stand and it's kind of assembled. But what has to happen now is basically like weeks of me. Weeks is probably overestimating, but like a lot of time of me calibrating this thing and like profiling all my papers and stuff. So I've been focusing on just getting lab orders out before that happens. But
well, it sounds like all you did was open the crate and crack open a beer and look at it and say, "Wow, magnificent."
Yeah. Well, we did have beers, but we saved the beers for when we went inside.
Oh, okay.
We actually went inside and listened to Purple Rain and drank beers, which is a very masculine thing to do.
It sounds like a wonderful day.
It was great. The other thing I did that I don't know if I sort of announced this, but I did pick up, and I've started to install my second SP3000. That's the Fuji Frontier scanner. Yeah, it's going to mean faster scans for everybody. I've assembled that. I had to order a monitor for it, so that's kind of coming in the mail. This is like inside baseball for labs, but it's not up and running yet just because of a couple of components that I still need, such as the monitor and a couple like power issues. But, you know, that's going to be installed soon, and I'll be able to double up how much film I can scan, get scans out faster. Even though I'm processing a lot faster with the Noritsu V30, which we're going to talk about later in this podcast, I would say that I'm still like a little bit of a bottleneck because everything has to be filtered through the same Fuji scanner or the scanner that I'm doing for like bordered scans. So that takes a little time. I'm just kind of tweaking and optimizing everything just to get everything as fast as possible. I don't think I'm ever going to be like one of these labs that is like focused on like, we will get you scans in 2 days. But, you know, I want to be like 3 to 5 days. That's kind of where I want to be so I can ensure quality and like a reasonable turnaround.
Yeah, within like a week of arriving. So if it arrives on a Monday, people have their stuff before the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, and there will be times where if I'm not super busy, if somebody sends me like 2 rolls of CD41, I could get that done like maybe even same day. But it would just depend on like the workflow that I had in front of me.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm still.
I think that's more than fair, anyways.
I'm still drying black and white like by air, basically. So that takes a while. The setup for that takes a while. E6 is still like a slow turnaround only because it's a volume issue. I still don't have like a ton of clients that shoot it. So I have to wait until I have kind of enough to fill a processing drum and then I can do a run. So I'm, you know, that is like kind of every 2 weeks I'm able to do a processing run there. But, you know, the quality that I'm getting from it is really high. And you know, I think people have kind of an expectation that slides just take a little longer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it is with any of the other big labs. You know, I think they all have that kind of same issue with, you know, E6 is the turnaround time because they have to do it in different batches or they have to, you know, mail it out and then get it back and then scan it. So,
yeah, a lot of labs, I think some people know this, but a lot of labs outsource the E6. I think that there's like really not that many labs that do it in-house. We kind of talked about this in our own Slack channel, but like people that have like labs that have their own dip and dunk line, like dip and dunks are these massive machines that can process like a ton of rolls at once. They have a little bit more flexibility in terms of like control, in terms of how much time the film is in the processor. And, you know, for pushing, you can push up to like, you can push to like an eighth of a stop, which is something that used to be popular when slides were like shot day in and day out for commercial purposes. I think there's only a few labs in the country now that maintain deep dip and dunk E6 lines. And I bet you a lot of labs like contract with these, which is, it's good, I guess, because it takes a ton of volume to maintain those. I use my chemistry kind of one shot. So it costs me more than it does to like per roll than these dip and dunk operations, but it's not so bad. And I'm able to kind of work it into my pricing and, I wouldn't want to do it. I wouldn't want to contract out my E6 because I like having the control and flexibility that it gives me to do my own pushing. I can push too, like to basically 5 second increments using the processor that I have. So I have the same flexibility. It's just a lot of setup time because I have to mix every chemical step before each run, and you know it. So there's like, it's very involved versus like when I run a roll of C41, I basically turn on my processor, attach the film to the leader card and I can run it through and it's done in 8 minutes. So a little different there.
You should just get a V30 just for E6.
I don't think it exists.
No, I don't think it does either.
I mean, it probably does. There's a lot of like mysterious things in film that you find out about. My friend Ryan, who runs a lab, he was telling me that he has a V30, which what we're talking for our listeners, is a roller transport processor. You know, they would have it in like a Walmart, you know, you run your film through it. Basically you attach your film to these leader cards and like shoot it through and it goes through all the different tanks and comes out dry at the end. Whereas most labs for black and white film use like a rotary or a dip and dunk thing where it's kind of spinning in a drum with chemicals. But I guess Ilford made a roller transport processor for black and white.
What?
And it was called like the FP40. I don't get it though, because like I got to ask him about how it works. I guess he says that there's only like four ever brought to the United States or something like that.
Okay. So it's not really like a feasible kind of thing to have anyways.
But what doesn't make sense to me is like the chemical processes. Cause like I get my chemical processes from the manufacturer or the massive dev chart and, or the times, I mean. So like, I'll be like, okay, somebody's pushing HP5 one stop. I'll go to the Ilford and I'll be like, what's one stop in Xtal 1:1? Okay. It's this time. And then I use that time. But with these roller transport processors, it's like you process all the different films at one time, and then they made this like special developer that worked with all the films.
What?
Because, you know, like when you use a roller transport processor, for the most part, it goes the same speed through all the chemical steps. So you can't really change times. There's a couple processors that let you, but they only let you slow it down. You can't really speed it up.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, there's lots of mysterious things in film that you find out about, especially as you run a lab, and they're like, oh, well, you need to speed this up. Well, Noritsu made this little robot that would extract film liters from 35 millimeter cassettes. There's like six of them in the United States. And you're just like, how do I get one of those? Yeah. And then you find out that like some other lab has one, and you're just like, what? How? Like what? The auto carrier for Fuji SP3000s?
Oh, yeah.
There's like six of those ever made, and like my friend who happened, I don't know how he had one, but he had one, and he like tried to get information from Fujifilm about it, and they were like, we never made that, it doesn't exist. And he's like, I have it in my hands. He's like, I'm holding it.
Well, see, that's what I was gonna say. Like, this has to be like the biggest issue with those kind of like one of four kind of things is like, where do you go for even information on it? Or if you sent that to Fuji, what would they, how would they even be able to repair that? I mean, I don't even know if they'd be able to repair it anyways, but like that, it's like you said, like they're the guy that probably designed that thing is probably gone now. Not necessarily dead, but you know,
yeah,
away.
The guy that makes my black and white and E6 processor retired. And I called the company and they were like, I was like, can I talk to him? And they were like, no.
Can I have his like cell phone number, email?
I was like, can I just email him with a question? And they were like, no. So I was like, great. Which is a
forwarding address?
Yeah, they were like, he's not talking to people. But that is a great segue into the main topic of today's scary stories to tell in the dark room. This is actually a scary story. So for once, like, I think it's going to fit the title.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you want to introduce these two Petapixel articles that came out, like Deep Impact and Armageddon at the same time?
Yeah. Okay. So there were, they're very clickbaity, as Petapixel normally is. One of the titles of the article was Film is Alive, but it may have a terminal illness. And it was pretty much this long, drawn-out article about nothing until it got to the very bottom, where it said why film's death clock is ticking. And it's pretty much saying that professional mini-lab scanners are key to film's continued survival, which, you know, I kind of agree with. I kind of don't. And then there was another article a couple days after that. It says why the film lab of the future is open source, which pretty much talks about how you're going to have to use DSLR scanning or using, you know, crowdfunded kind of automatic film processors and things like that, and pretty much doing away with V30s after all the parts are gone, the people that can repair them are gone for, you know, one reason or another, you know, and just different like operating systems and things like that to make it all work for specific, you know, film, like commercial film lab usage, and not just people at home doing this, you know, in their basement.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue that, I mean, on some level, I disagree with the premise of these articles. On another level, like, it is something I think about. Like, like Fuji SP3000s have not been made in a while. Their parts, you can get parts for them from Fuji. They cost, like, relative to what these things used to sell for new, which was like $100,000. Yeah. Newsflash, I didn't pay that for my, or anything close to that for my SP3000s. Like a part of running a lab, I tell everybody this, part of running a lab is basically maintaining this equipment that has a lot of moving parts. It will be old. It will rely on electronics, which, you know, if you've spent a lot of time buying or selling film cameras, you know, are the weakest element of these of any like item, because they fail and you can't really fix like a bad circuit board.
Yeah.
You can only like replace it. Or if you can, most shops don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
I think about it a lot. I mean, you know, my business is based on this equipment. But there's other things that I think give me like a lot of hope. I am seeing new technology that makes scanning a lot more, like I can suddenly visualize a scanner that's not an SP3000 that gives me the results that an SP3000 does. I don't think we're anywhere close to that. I'm using some of that technology in my, like in my bordered scans and in my E6 scans and in my 4x5 scans. But they're not automated. It's kind of slow, and that's why there's like an extra fee attached to them.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a little clunkier right now. But you know, I disagree with the premise that like these mini lab scanners are the end all be all for commercial film labs, because I do think there's options out there. Well, not necessarily out there right now, but there's a market for somebody to create something that could, you know, work for commercial labs that could replace, you know, the Fuji Frontiers and the Noritsus and things like that.
Yes. I mean, one fear that I would have is if anybody like, I don't know, like let's say Kodak decided to step up and they're like, well, you know, scanners haven't been updated in a while and we want to keep selling film, so we're going to make one. One fear that I have is that they would make it and they would base it on the old model where they're going to sell these things to labs and they would be extremely expensive.
Yeah.
Like, I think that there's only a handful of labs that could afford what they used to sell for brand new. Like, you know, $100,000 investment is kind of a non-starter, because when everybody was developing film, like you could see like a timeline where you could pay that back.
Yeah. Definitely.
But now that it's kind of this small group of photography enthusiasts, well, not even small, just like when it's just reduced to purely photography enthusiasts or professional photographers, that kind of like $100,000 investment is not going to happen unless you are one of the major labs in this country. And I would hate to see all scans filtered through an even smaller pipeline of labs. Like,
definitely
having more labs doing more services is good. Like, it doesn't annoy me that there's other labs in other regions that are smaller than some of the bigger labs, like even though they might be taking film away from me, because like, who knows, maybe they're going to come up with some process that is better for all film photographers, because you want kind of this diverse group of people serving the photography community. At least I think that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely agree. I also think that, you know, maybe this scanner, whatever it is, or in whatever form it could come from, might not necessarily even come from someone like Kodak. I think Kodak's resources are invested heavily into the production of film itself. And while they want to see it continue, I don't know if they have the infrastructure or the R&D money to put into developing a new scanner based on new technology, if that makes any sense. Like, let's take the Pacon, for example. That thing is fine for what it was a long time ago. They sell for an obscene amount of money, but they still use like a, you know, 12 megapixel CCD, you know, sensor. I just think if you wanted to use like a newer version of a CMOS sensor and develop a new, you know, software to run on current operating systems and things like that, it would require a significant investment of time and monetary resources that someone like Kodak necessarily can't afford. But somebody who is more well-versed and has the time to kind of do that stuff on their own could come up with something more open source that another company could purchase. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's kind of the other article mentioned this. He was kind of saying that the future is open source, that it's going to be these kind of open technologies that everybody can kind of have access to. I don't know if I completely agree with his premise. I don't know if he's kind of envisioning sort of like a kumbaya thing. Like, some of the products that he mentioned that have come out recently to develop film are like the Filmomat, which is this kind of this little film processor that some European guy made recently. It kind of went around on Kickstarter. I don't know if it was a Kickstarter, but it went around like a few years ago. But I mean, it looks really modern and really cool and probably does a great job developing film. But the problem is like, it can only do two rolls at a time.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, okay, maybe some home user wants to do that, but the thing costs like $5,000 for two roles at a time. Like, are you kidding me? Like, I'm developing eight roles at a time in my smallest film processor.
Yeah.
And I'm doing, like, you know, maybe up to 30 roles a day, sometimes more than that, sometimes a little less, but I mean, two at a time, that's not happening. But I could see a guy like that making a product that could be scaled up.
Yes.
But I don't think it needs to be like open source. I just think that it needs to exist. I think like the thing that gives me a lot of hope is like what we've seen with Pack Film and Instant Film is that Polaroid went under and then this company's kind of sprang up in the wake of that to serve these communities. Like, I could see that happening in film processing, especially once Noritsu parts for their processors or Fuji or whomever you might be using become like less and less available. Like, somebody, I think like these machines are complex, but they're not rocket science.
Yeah.
Like, and on scanners, it doesn't have to be this high tech cutting edge piece of technology. Like, it would be complex, especially because it's pretty necessary to have like auto transporters. So you need moving parts and things like that. Like, it's like, it probably wouldn't be cheap. Although your average internet commenter seems to think that like everyone should be able to afford these things for $100, but really, like, it doesn't, you know, if it used a 5-year-old CMOS sensor, that would be way more than adequate.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if somebody could come up with a way to, it would pretty much, I guess it would be kind of similar to the way a PacCon works. If somebody could come up with like a way to take even a D850 sensor or an A7R2 sensor or something like that, and like take the shell off of the camera and work out a way to where, you know, it reads when the film is going across and it can fit all of the image onto a photograph or a sensor or whatever, and then it automatically takes a photo and then it slides on to the next one and it just kind of does it like an automated thing. I mean, I wouldn't think that would be too difficult to make, but I haven't seen anybody do it and I definitely cannot do it myself. So I don't know what's involved in it. It's just kind of an idea, but I would think that, you know, somebody could come out with something like that. My issue with a lot of these startups is that they go under after a while. And I think we need to see a company come in that can sustain some kind of repair service or back-end service for these labs that could potentially purchase their products.
Yeah, that brings me actually one thing. I've kind of wanted to talk about this, and this is a good opportunity. So we've seen like a lot of these Kickstarters come out, and we've seen other people make announcements, even if they're not Kickstarters. Like, Japan Camera Hunter says he's going to make like a high-end point-and-shoot to sort of replace the Contax T2, like a new one.
Yeah.
Whether that happens, I don't know. Like, theoretically, he's working on it. Reflex, I think they're called Reflex, is making like a new SLR that's kind of
modular.
It's 35 millimeter. It's supposed to, like, you can swap out the lens mount somehow. Other companies I've seen just like they announce that they're going to make like some new piece of equipment and they do a Kickstarter. But my feeling is that it would be maybe not as sexy, but I just feel like some company needs to come out or some group of people needs to come out and say, guess what we're going to do? We're going to keep all of the existing film equipment, or at least like most of them, completely operational. And we're going to make new parts if necessary. We're going to make new circuit boards. Like, this stuff is possible. Like, people can print circuit boards. People can make small parts for cameras. And we're just going to keep these things working because there is, we have, you know, what we have like 100 years of film cameras. Like, I think we have enough to feed the market.
Yeah.
And if somebody was like, I'm going to keep, I like to give you an example, I don't know that this guy is fabricating any new parts. I don't know. I doubt that he is, but I bought a TLR this year, a twin lens reflex Rolleiflex from a guy in Germany who goes by the name of like Magic Flex on Instagram. And this thing was made to like new specification because he completely took it apart and completely put it back together. And I've seen some of his like Instagram videos in terms of what he's doing. And he's just completely refabbing these things to be, I mean, it was like buying a new Rolleiflex.
Yeah. I remember when you bought it and I went online and I looked at his stuff and he's like showing, taking each and every screw and all these little individual pieces and putting them in bowls full of cleaning solution. And like you said, making them look brand new. It's crazy.
Opening up the lenses, doing everything. Like, we need somebody like him for everything. You know, we need like him to, I mean, you see this with Leica, where these, all these independent shops that kind of like are these Leica experts. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that some of them can fabricate parts maybe like to a small degree, but I mean, if they're keeping 100-year-old like 3Fs or however the old those are running, we just need somebody to be able to do that with like a Nikon FM2 that has a circuit board.
Yeah. Well,
be able to make a new circuit board. I mean, they're not that complex.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like, kind of like you had said, like I was kind of leading up to that point as well, as thinking that, you know, it would be really cool if a company could come out and, like you said, find a way to create new circuit boards or repurpose these electronic components or recreate these electronic components within these, you know, processors at the very least, in terms of like talking about things that a lab could use. You know, I can see somebody doing that, and I don't know why that would be that hard, unless it's maybe a patent or a copyright issue with Fuji or something like that, which might be more difficult to get around. I don't know how Fuji would feel about somebody recreating circuit boards and reselling them.
Well, I just think, I mean, this gets into like a little bit of a kind of a gray area, but they would need to be fine with basically saying that they're no longer going to make money off the Fuji SP3000. Yeah. But I mean, if they're not going to support it anyway, I don't know why that they would feel like they shouldn't let somebody else support it. I mean, I think that the scanners are the most complicated elements, because computer stuff is of its time, and to get like a company to make a bunch of like chips that are based on 10-year-old technology, I don't know. Like, I think that smarter people would have a better answer than I can have. But I mean, in terms of like my Noritsu processor, like a lot of its components are, there's a computer that's probably not any more advanced than like a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
And the rest is like, there's a lot of like little parts like gears, but again, they're like mostly some kind of, not plastic, but like a composite. And then there's heating elements, there's water pumps and some tanks and tubing. There's not a ton else that's like super complex, you know, that there's a little guillotine system that like snips the back of the film as it's kind of exiting the canister. These things can be made again, like somebody can, especially with manufacturing in China, where you have them coming up, like if they can make those stupid hoverboards that burst into flames, I feel like they can make a pump for my Noritsu.
Well, you know, even for stuff like that, I'm sure that there's already existing things, like for a pump, I'm sure there's already existing things that you could buy from, you know, some kind of store that you could use in place of that. Nobody's just done it yet. It wouldn't surprise me if some of these things already exist and people just haven't gotten to the point of desperation where they have to go out and try and repurpose something from something else.
I guess that's my broader point, is like, just keep the equipment that we have running. You know, be like one of these big cinema companies that like Panavision, that's been making, that doesn't make new film cameras because they don't need to. All the film cameras that they have are fine. They just keep them running. Yeah. Like all the Nikons that we have are enough. All the Leicas that we have are probably enough. And you can buy a new MA if you're a crazy person. But you know, like, and Leica will still service it in theory, I guess.
Well, there's other places that are.
But yeah, well, they're not doing it themselves. Like if I sent them an M6 that was like broken, I mean, they would fix that, right?
Well, I think there are, well, back to the whole circuit board issue, I think the M6 TTL meters and stuff, I don't think those can be fixed anymore because of parts availability. And, you know, same deal with like the M7s and all that garbage too. It's more just parts availability. And anything mechanical, I think they can totally fix, because you know, you can fab parts for a mechanical camera and it doesn't matter.
Yeah. See, this is what we need. We just need somebody that can print these circuit boards or do whatever they need to do. I don't know how complex that is. Maybe they could find some way to just scale down the manufacturing. I mean, there's certainly going to be a need for that going forward.
Yeah.
As we kind of are exiting the like different eras of like electronic components for all types of things that people have, they want to just keep them running. And not making new things is like if you want to get a little kind of green energy focused, you're not contributing to like further waste. You know, you're
repurposing something.
Yeah. We don't need a new Hasselblad.
Yeah.
We need all the Hasselblads that exist to continue to be serviced.
Yes.
And we definitely don't need any new Noritsu film processors. We just need all of the ones that exist to keep working.
Yes.
I mean, that's kind of my feeling. Although, I mean, you know, and there are some new things. I think you can still buy some of the new dip and dunk processors that like larger labs are using. Like Refrema seems to still be around. I think that like Indie Film Lab has a few Refremas.
Yeah.
Because they must be doing just like ridiculous volume.
Oh, I'm sure.
To keep those things going.
I think RPL has a dip and dunk as well.
I'm sure that they do. Somebody told me that they do 1,000 rolls a day.
That's a whole lot of rolls.
I find that a little hard to believe.
It's many, many rolls.
But it's possible.
I'm trying to think of it's really just hard for me to believe that there's enough people out there that are shooting enough just to send to like one specific lab that would get 1,000 rolls a day.
They are kind of like the mothership for a lot of people. Even when I didn't have the lab, I didn't use them. I just thought like they were too expensive.
Yes.
I mean, part of the reasons why I started my lab is because I thought that like a lot of labs are too expensive. But I don't know. You know, they definitely have like that whole like wedding look down. So I can see why people would use them, but I don't necessarily know why that would facilitate them getting 1,000 rolls a day. Maybe they do. I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of people that are interested in film, especially more and more. So I don't know. I hope that they are, I guess.
That's a lot of light and airy brides on film.
I hope that maybe a chunk of those people start sending me film.
That would be wonderful.
Why don't they do that?
It'd be wonderful.
Yeah. It would be wonderful. But yeah, so I don't know. I don't worry too much anymore about the future of film because I've seen back to topic, I've seen sort of just the fact that they're like making pack film again now, and even in kind of like a weird gimpy form that they're doing it. It's given me like a lot of hope that this stuff is going to still be around, and the interest is definitely there. I mean, C41 film has way more interest than Polaroid ever did. So like presumably people would still want this stuff to continue being in existence. And I mean, I'm not, some people come back to like, they always say that they want, they think that film making a comeback means like, it's going to be like the way it was, when there wasn't digital. That's like, no, ridiculous. That's never going to happen. But the way we have it right now, I think is pretty good. I mean, scans that we're delivering are really high quality. The films that we have are great. There's a lot of choices and a lot of options, and people are able to get like, they're able to make high quality prints and get high quality scans easier than they ever could before. Like in some ways, this is a great time to be shooting film.
It is. I agree.
Yeah. I'm not so like dire about the future. I think like we're actually living in kind of a heyday right now. And that's cool. I think that's really cool.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, I think film is, I definitely don't think it's going anywhere. You know, as long as there's people out there who want to, you know, choose their own medium, I think it's going to be around.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons, like if you look at like digital cameras, is one of the reasons why you have better digital cameras coming out. I think, I don't know this for sure, this is a theory that I have, but I think that one of the reasons why you have better digital cameras from Fuji coming out, or Sony even, they're focusing on full frame and they're focusing on kind of high end cameras, is that the consumer market is gone. So they have to focus on people that are either enthusiastic about photography or the professionals.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true in film.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Like I don't have,
we talked about this when we worked at B&H, like how many point and shoots did we sell? Or did we like even just deter people from buying when they're holding an iPhone X in their hand that's going to take a better photo? Those people don't need to buy you know, point and shoots. I think the consumer market, like you said, the consumer market is pretty much gone for, you know, any like high volume camera manufacturer. And it leaves the market for advanced amateurs or enthusiasts or professionals. And I think film kind of falls in that mix between professionals and enthusiasts. And I think there's a market for it, but I think there always will be.
Well, and the people that are serving it and the people that are making film, they're going to focus on that kind of enthusiast professional market. So, you know, instead of having like a new point and shoot come out from Nikon or whatever, they might make like some kind of special edition. Like they're like the only camera they make now is the F6, because the only people that are buying a film camera from them are pros. I mean, Nikon's probably a bad example because I don't know, who knows if they even make it again, but like, look at like Rolly with the high six that I have and basically no one else has. Like, you know, this is like some high end piece of professional equipment, and they don't need to focus on things like, you know, a million point and shoots that they'd rather sell and make more money off of that. They're focusing on me. Like, finally, the industry, like what I'm trying to say is that the market is really focusing on us.
Yeah.
Kodak is doing that with new films like Ektachrome. They're not trying to make a new consumer film. I mean, they have kind of their branding stuff, but they're not making like weird little consumer products and like little scan stations at places. No, they're like, they want Mark and Brennan to shoot Ektachrome, so they're making it. And that's great.
I'm all about Mark and Brennan shooting more Ektachrome. I love Ektachrome.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
You've been, I don't know, I don't think it's a secret really that I keep, but you, Brennan does my Instagram. We have been posting some of the Ektachromes from Stephen Byrne, who goes by Floral Aggressor on Instagram. I think it's at Floral Aggressor. Mm-hmm. His stuff was rad. I mean, from what you saw of it, didn't you think so?
Hell yes. His travel stuff with Ektachrome looked so freaking good. Like that's like what it was made for. It looked so perfect.
I didn't tell him we were going to talk about him today, but I just kind of, because we were talking about Ektachrome. Yeah, he took advantage of the new E6 scans that I'm doing. So he sent in 10 or 12 rolls of mostly Ektachrome, some Fuji stuff like Provia and Velvia. It seems like he shot it all with a Leica. I think it was like an M6, it seemed like. I mean, I saw some like mirror selfies with it. Like the quality was just crazy. The colors were perfect. Like, some of these images, they appear almost like grainless. They had that kind of classic chrome contrast range where it's just like delicate highlights and like dense shadows, but, you know, kind of really nice mid to like for travel. It was just like that National Geographic aesthetic from, you know, 30 years ago. And it was a pleasure to scan his stuff, and I'm glad we've been like sharing it.
No, I agree. And that, when you said like the kind of National Geographic look, you know, that's kind of what it reminded me of, like just nice, big, bright, vibrant colors that weren't overly unnaturally saturated, but nice, dark, inky blacks and highlights that weren't totally gone. It was pretty. Like that's like what everything should look like. It looked awesome.
I think a lot of people that shoot 120 because they don't like the grain of 35 millimeter or kind of like the low contrast that can sometimes happen if they expose 35 badly would really be into slide film in 35, because when they're traveling or something, like I don't know. I think that the gap gets a little narrower between 120 and like C41 medium format, because E6 films are just higher quality by nature of them. Except for the dynamic range. But when you nail the exposure and you have kind of the scene that's good for it, you just get these grainless images that are just gorgeous. So I hope that more people pick up Ektachrome, and especially when you're traveling, there's really no excuse not to. Like, shoot it in a Leica or an old Nikon or whatever it might be. You're going to get really high quality, and definitely send it to me, because
then you'll get the highest quality. Like we do.
Well, nobody's scanning it like we do. I mean, I just had a conversation with somebody that called to inquire at the lab and saying that he wasn't happy with the way Frontier or Noritsu rendered slide film. And I was like, yeah, well, let me try. And I sent him some samples, and it makes a big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, this new process that I'm using, It captures what the film actually looks like. So I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely the way to go. And I really hope everybody continues to buy it and send it to whoever in general, because I really want to see it in 120. My Rolly needs some Ektachrome in 120.
Yeah, that's like a big factor for me. I mean, I have a lot of Ektachrome in my fridge, but I haven't been shooting it very much because I'm a medium format photographer, I think. I like medium format. I like medium format cameras and 35 millimeter. I can get a really high quality negative, but I don't want 36 exposures of anything. Yeah. That's a lot. For me, that's a ton. That's a ton of frames. It's hard for me to get through a whole roll in like one shooting session. So
I agree 100%. It was a lot easier when I lived in New York and I shot a whole lot of, you know, street photography and stuff like that. You know, I could burn through a roll or two within, you know, a couple hours when I was out like attempting to shoot something. But now when I live, you know, since I live in Nashville now, it's like, I mean, and I can definitely be accused of not using my Rolly as much as I should anyways, but like now it takes me weeks to get through, you know, one roll of 35, and I carry, you know, my camera with me pretty much everywhere, whether it's my M3 or it's my 3G or my T4 or whatever. You know, I definitely don't shoot them as much as I should, and I should probably just carry my Rolly more. I just don't for some reason. It would make a lot more sense.
Well, yeah, you should do that. You should carry that Rolly around because you have a really nice Rolleiflex.
I really like that camera. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe that's what I'll go do after this.
Yeah. Yeah, you should. I guess being like a 3.5 is sometimes limiting, but I don't know. I mean, you shoot with like a don't you shoot with a like an X-Pro 2 and your film cameras, basically. That's all you have.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah, and my X-Pro 2, I really don't even – the only reason I even use my X-Pro 2 is for my wife's social media stuff. Outside of social media content for her Instagram, I don't use the X-Pro 2 at all. It's not that I just don't like the digital workflow, but, you know, that's another topic for another day. But my 3G has an f3.2 lens on it, and I do just fine on it. So
– no, there you go. So it's not that limiting. I mean, mine's a 2.8. I mean, all my Rolleiflex – all my medium format stuff are 2.8. I don't have like a Contax with an F2 lens. And I also don't really feel limited. One thing I've learned is to try to carry just one camera.
Yeah.
Over the years. So yeah, typically, even though I love my Hi6 and like the quality I get from it is better than I get from almost any camera I've ever owned, I end up just carrying around my 2.8E because it's just like, so simple. It does not require a lot of accessories. And the 2.8D being the TLR.
Yeah.
You could have like a small bag with it. And yeah, it's 12 frames on a roll. Like I always just take my best pictures with it.
Yeah. Well, I definitely agree. And I don't like, you know, carrying multiple cameras and multiple lenses for any reason either. So usually when I go out, if I'm shooting stuff with, you know, my wife, then I'll take the X-Pro 2 and like one lens, but then my film stuff, either a 3G or an M3, and I'll just stick it in my, either my bag or, you know, if it's my 3G, I can almost stick it in my back pocket. And since it's winter, I just throw it in a coat pocket and it's fine. I like having, you know, not a lot of equipment.
Yeah. I did have one more topic I wanted to talk about, and this is a little bit impromptu, but I kind of wanted to make this not such a gear podcast. And I wanted to discuss basically how to approach creating a project in photography, because I think that a lot of people, don't think about that very, very often. Like, I guess I would just start by like asking you, like, how do you think about making new pictures and what you're going to do with those pictures after you've made them? Do you ever think about that?
I'm going to be honest. I don't. I go out and I just take photos that I think I'm going to enjoy at some point in the future. I guess I think more about photos that I want to look back on at some point. You know what? We'll take this back a little bit. When I lived in New York, I liked doing street photography and taking those kinds of photos. mostly just because it was something that I enjoyed photographing and it was something that was around me at the time. And now when I shoot, I'm not necessarily shooting that kind of stuff anymore. So I want to take photos of things that I want to remember in the future. So trips that I get to take with my wife, or just doing things with my wife in general, or, you know, something like that. Just something that's going to bring me back to the time that I photographed and that. And that's really about the extent of my thought process behind why I photograph certain things. But in terms of like the medium, I have no idea.
I think that a lot of my clients shoot in kind of a similar way. And like a lot of people do approach photography that way. I mean, people have different like definitions about what photography is for them, and that's totally fine. I always, since college, basically have thought about my photography in terms of like a project. So I will think up, I have to have an idea, and then I have to kind of set limits because I'm really ADD. So that might be like, okay, so you're going to shoot this all on like one or two formats. So like when I was doing the prison project, I said, I'm going to shoot all the details and 6x6, and then I'm going to shoot all the portraits in 4x5. And that was all I could do. It wasn't going to go and just kind of like see what happened with like a bunch of different cameras. I say like, okay, how many pictures should this be? I think like, okay, this should be like 20 photographs. And for me, when you approach a photo project, like I think those limits focus my mind, and I'm able to kind of create a portfolio that sort of makes sense. And that's just my personal approach to it. I would love to know, like, from people who listen to this podcast or use the lab, like how they think about it. It definitely results in me not shooting as much. Like, I'm not one of these photographers that always has a camera on me. When I went home for Christmas, for instance, I didn't even bring a camera other than my smartphone. I just knew it wasn't going to happen. And so I'm like much more, I'm just much more like considered about each photograph that I make. And I'm not saying that there's like a right answer to this. It's definitely not. Like, people work in different ways, but I think like I have to ask myself as a photographer, like, why am I making photographs? What are my photographs for? How do I want my photographs to be around when I don't necessarily have control over the work? And I hope for most people, especially people that shoot film, that the point of their photography is not to exist on Instagram.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. I'm not going to bring it up now because we're already running short on time, but there is another article that I want to send you with a couple comments attached to it that I think would be a good topic for this. I'm just not going to talk about it now. We'll talk about it later.
Okay.
I need to like recollect my thoughts on it.
Yeah. This was an impromptu subject, and this was a very like low research day, to be honest. Like, I have a million orders at the lab that I'm trying to get through, but we'll get there,
yes,
I suppose.
We'll make it.
Yeah, we'll make it through. Okay. Well, I guess we could call it a podcast here. I'm going to try to do an interview with somebody over the next couple weeks. I'm still learning how to podcast, so I don't know how it's going to work. But once I figure out how it's supposed to work, I will do that interview. otherwise, do you have any parting thoughts for our dear listeners?
Be deliberate with your photographs, people. Think about what you're, just think about what you're doing, why you're doing it.
Think about why you're doing it. One thing I should say is, if somebody asks you why you're making photographs a certain way, you should have a really good answer.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to call out anybody. I'm not going to say the rest of this because it's gotten me into trouble before. But if somebody says, like, why are you taking this kind of photograph, and you don't have an answer for them, like, you should.
I agree.
You know who you are. All right. Well, Brennan.
Well, Mark.
I hope you enjoy the rest of your week. I'm going to go get some beers tonight after I develop film for hours. I'm living my best life.
It sounds like it. Beers and printers just sitting around, not doing any printing, and orders to get out.
Oh, shut up. I'm going to turn the printer on soon. Oh my God. Hey, I would love it if somebody had ideas about their ideal print company, since I am launching this, like, I would love to hear those. The part I'm really dreading, and not to drag this out more, but the part I'm really dreading is like building the website portion of it that has like an e-commerce functionality. I hate that.
Yeah, it's not fun.
Like, setting up the printer is going to be a joy, but like doing the website part of it and then making all the pictures and making my print lab look all fancy.
Exciting times ahead.
That's going to suck. I want to use this pod to like give people a real insight into like what it's like to have one of these businesses. I hope that they understand.
A lot of time. It takes a lot of time.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, good luck out there.
Thanks. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.